Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Amid persistent calamity and disasters and plummeting hopes for the future, a single death yet retains a power to put the rest into personal context. This past week, I received a letter from my friend David Horowitz, who wrote that a mutual friend of ours had died in early September. Her name was Marjorie Sharp. She died primarily from a failing heart. By all accounts, David wrote, she took strength and courage from the fact that she had lived a stimulating and exciting life of adventure and spiritual exploration and was completely reconciled to the end. She was born the same year David and I were, 1941, she in February, David and me 2 days apart in August. Marjorie was, as another friend, David Milholland, wrote in Eulogy, a global citizen who traveled extensively, living for long periods in Nepal and Thailand, while maintaining a strong friendship circle among the creative community of Portland. She expressed great satisfaction with her life, Milholland wrote in his eulogy, 76 years filled with friendship, planetary adventure, and intrigue, no fear of the future, and no sudden need to embrace anyone's defined faith. Marjorie, as Milholland said, played a memorable role in Penny Allen's first feature film, Property. Her early life and writing are central to Worthy Advisor, co-authored with Suzanne Stanton, and she was a key inspiration for Catherine Dunn's 1989 magnum opus, Geek Love. Catherine Dunn died last year in May 2016. David Horowitz included a review he wrote of Worthy Advisor in 1973 for the Portland State University publication, The Vanguard. On another front, he wrote, I have also included two letters detailing some of my thoughts of our fragile democracy. Horowitz has written a number of books primarily on United States political history and an autobiography of his pursuit of the underlying realities of American orthodoxy. I start this program today with his long-ago review of Worthy Advisor. And this is by David Horowitz, with a quote by S.J. Stanton. Nobody gets out of life alive, I guess. Smack in the middle of a summer's reading, a character popped up and announced that his only living faith was that somewhere there was something to have faith in. In this waning season of the American century, remember he wrote this in 1973, it is no longer insane to ask where in the universe anyone finds their faith. A few touchstones remain. Political revolutionaries look to the People's Republic. Liberals pray to process and principle. Jews pledge legacies to the Holy Land. Moral conservatives mobilize against abortion and pornography. Scores of retired acid freaks have come round to Jesus, the perfect master of primal scream. More conventional souls still put their meaning in nature, progress, money, or even love. But for many who emerged into adulthood out of the promise of the 60s, the hard rain hasn't seeded the plain. The place is flooded with defeat, tired, quiet, played out warriors, embittered and without hope, trudging off to survival, Inc. Each day is another testament to failure and impotence. Their visionless future looms as a repetition of late-night commercials. After all, the chord changes from innocence to cynicism are very minor. Into this bleak vacuum comes Worthy Advisor, a small book put together by S.J. Stanton, who lives in Portland and occasionally attends Portland State University. Worthy Advisor is a collage of the life and times of Ms. Maybelline Spear Beaver Wallace Walpot, sometimes known as Gypsy, sometimes as Marjorie. The variety of last names belong to a multitude of husbands who crossed Gypsy's path. Among other things, Marjorie was Worthy Advisor in the Rainbow Girls in Milton Freewater, Oregon, back in the 1950s. There are many things to explore in this portrait of the struggle to create humor and poetry out of survival. Some of them are stories which many women are first feeling free to share with each other, accounts of vacant husbands and unloving lovers, pregnancy and childbirth, rape and abortion, male ego and violence, or of the host of body-hustling dentists, priests, lawyers, doctors, and bosses who don't give away anything free. But Worthy Advisor is not a catalog of horror stories and downtrips. It's beautifully designed composite of poems, letters, diary entries, tape transcripts, and photographs speak of affirmation and celebration, not retreat. Somewhere in the pages of this little book, you remember what it's like to be alive, the freedom that comes when you let dung come down on you but never let it immerse you. Somewhere you remember that the toughness of the hustle need not destroy the tenderness of the spirit. Your fire is a celebration and a warning, Suzanne Stanton warns her sister Fish, and the book ends with a line from one of Gypsy's poems, "Yeah, here I brink, not being pushed or pulled." In its off-the-wall directness, Worthy Advisor is something like a book of faith for our times. It goes beyond cynicism to celebrate life. It goes beyond oppression to celebrate womanness and humanness. It goes beyond despair to celebrate the universe, kind of like listening to Bessie Smith sing blues. Somehow, if we are all to survive with any energy in the severity of the 70s, the innocence of the 60s must go somewhere besides self-hate and cynicism. Nobody, Gypsy, nor the guru Maharaji, outlined the path to faith in ourselves. But once in a while, Worthy Advisor flashes you at the excitement of being alive in the universe. And even after all the guanos come down, the tenderness and strength that sometimes comes out of human beings. And as I earlier said, David A. Horowitz wrote this for his weekly column, Freeway, in the Portland State University campus newspaper, The Vanguard, on September 9th, 1973. Suzanne Stanton, who authored Worthy Advisor with Marjorie, died many years ago at an early age. And from Worthy Advisor, I would like to read some excerpts from Marjorie, aka MSBBWW. These are excerpts from the book Worthy Advisor. "I am sending you, Suzanne Stanton, some pictures I found. The one of the group is of me when I was the Worthy Advisor to the Rainbow Girls. The Rainbow Girls in this thing, like part of the Masons and the Eastern Star. The Rainbow Girls are for the girls, and the boys are for the Demolay boys. It's a fraternal order that is just a ritualistic bunch of BS. I mean, maybe they have a bake sale now and then. They have creeds and a book they call the Ritual Book, and it's red. Looks like the quotations of Chairman Mao. Anyway, you start out at certain stations. There's faith, hope, charity, and the Worthy Advisor, and each is represented by a girl. You are voted into office of faith, first of all, and then you take the other chairs as the next person is voted into the chair of faith. You have to learn by heart, without looking at the book, what faith or the others has to say in the ritual. I was on this social trip because when I came to Oregon, I was a pachuca. I took a look around, decided to be on top of whatever was happening. I wanted a little social status, and the Rainbow Girls was good because you gain office by vote of popularity, like being a cheerleader was voted by the student body. Marjorie had been a high school cheerleader just before she married her first of four husbands. She married the first husband twice. The Worthy Advisor was important for that sort of thing. This is Marjorie again. It is sort of like a queen or a judge. You have a gavel and you wear a crown with rhinestones in it and a white dress. Everybody wears a white dress because of the purity thing, and they talk a lot about virginity in the rainbow. The Worthy Advisor gets the podium and the gavel and the white nylon formal and the rhinestone tiara. You never get to advise anybody. It's all written in the book. You just learn to say your piece out of the book. When you're crowned, your parents come and pin a corsage on you, and I think a demolay boy comes and does something to you. I had a crew cut then, and it poked up through my crown. I was in the pea festival parade a couple of times. In Milton Freewater, they have a pea festival every year with a pea queen and pea princesses. Every single girl gets a chance to be the pea queen. Milton Freewater was in Look magazine in 1961 as an all-American city. All fascist is what they mean. In 1958, I was in the parade on the Rexall float because my father knew the pharmacist. We wore bathing suits, and it was cold, and we were up there with crepe paper. Everything was crepe paper. Nothing was real. There weren't real flowers, just crepe paper and chicken wire and these things that bounce and funny cars that only the windshield shows so they can drive the floats. We sat with our hands behind us, one leg down, pointing the toe. The year I was worthy advisor, my mouth got quivery and I couldn't smile anymore while I was riding on the rainbow float. That year, I would have been a senior, but I married Jimmy Beaver instead. My girlfriend, Pauline Peacock, and me were riding in the back seat of the 56 Buick on our way to the Rainbow Convention in Astoria. We drove from Milton Freewater to Astoria, which is about 350 miles or something like that, and there were no freeways. Mrs. S., who was the mother advisor, was driving. In the back seat with Pauline and myself was Janie Rechtenwald, and we were all going to the Rainbow Convention in Astoria, and Pauline Peacock told us about fellatio, and none of us had ever dreamed of it, I guess. We were all biting the backs of our hands and asking her more questions. She talked about Stanley B., who had red hair, who everyone called Standby. His father was the high school principal, and she was pregnant with Stanley B.'s baby. Pauline was voted Pea Festival Queen, the pregnant Pea Festival Queen of 1958. Stanley became a pharmacist, and she became a red-faced woman with a bad heart. Mrs. S. was a square woman who died of cancer. The one I married twice was Jimmy Beaver. I was telling you about Willie, John's father, who was my last legal one. He was a logger. His father was a logger, and his grandfather was a logger. We lived in Pierce, Idaho, in Clearwater County, near where the Clearwater River runs. God, I remember the winter Johnny was born. It was so damned cold. There were 62 inches of snow that January. The closest hospital and doctor were 38 miles down the grade, and we had to wait for the plow to get down. We lived on the top of a mountain, and down the grade by the river there is a town called Orofino. In Orofino, there was a doctor I went to who wanted to know if my husband was willing to learn to deliver a baby, since he didn't think I should bother coming down. But Willie thought it was absurd. He just didn't want to care how to learn. He was busy. He was a sawyer. The only two doctors were pretty sleazy, big drinkers who lived in a trailer court. Pierce was a marvelous town. People shot holes in the tavern ceilings and killed their wives. The people work when it's time to work, and they work very hard, 14 hours a day. They work in snow up to their scrotums. When spring comes, there is this time they call the breakup, and the snow melts, and the ground becomes soft. The men can't work then, and they start to collect unemployment. They play cards, and they drink beer, and their conversations are about 85% cursing, and the rest are words. I mean, there is really not much said, but there is a lot talked about. They treat their women pretty heavy. If a dude's wife has a baby, he goes out to a local bar and buys drinks for the house with his paycheck. They gamble away their titles to their houses. They gamble away their cars. They gamble away their power saws. I think I married Willie in January. I loved the woods, and he was a logger. I was a nature freak, and he knew all about it. It was our compassion point. We were nature lovers, and so he took me to the woods. We lived near the Lolo Pass, where Lewis and Clark met Sacagawea when they were almost dead, between Montana and Idaho. There were bear there, caribou, the Bitterroot Mountains, Clearwater County, and Idaho. It's beautiful history. We were near Orofino, where they discovered gold in Idaho. And in the town we lived in, Pierce, there was a tree called the Hanging Tree. They hanged 5 Chinese there one night. There are still many Chinese coins and artifacts left in the town. I met an old surveyor who lived in the hotel. We became friends. There were some people who claimed some unclaimed land for mineral rights, and I got interested in it. My husband, Willie, thought it was absurd. While I was pregnant with John, the old German surveyor and I walked out the lines and hammered up the little things on the borders of the land. He got out the Forest Service maps, and so I got the mineral rights claim. The old German introduced me to some old-timers who were pensioners and old prospectors, and they taught me how to pan. I got what they call gold fever. You get a little tiny piece of gold and you just hunker down and really get into it. I would have my jeans rolled up above my knees and I had the big belly with John. And I would be standing in the creek with cold, cold water. And we would dig out river rock, put it in our pans and wash it down with a swish, swish, swish. My husband was always gone logging. And he thought it was absurd, like he did most things. He just didn't care how I spent my time. We came down from Pierce when I was 21. I just couldn't wait till I was 21 because I wanted to avenge my husband's drinking. Very few men live in housing projects, mostly women with kids from different husbands and all different races. That's why I got turned onto weed. I used to try things like taking a bath stoned, being alone without my kids, who I was super dependent on and didn't know it. I had 2 little kids screaming at me, grabbing me. They sucked off mama. I had that for so many years I didn't know how to be alone. I took a bus ride alone once when I was stoned and I didn't know what to do with my arms. I was always grabbing a kid off here or there or wiping the nose or something. When Stevie was born, I thought, far out, a baby. But I never thought about having that person grow up and dealing with him for 18 years. Violence happens a lot when I go out. I don't know what happens, but I can sit still and watch violence happen in front of me, and it's scary. It's like energy, but it's extreme. Women aren't supposed to be hostile, and sometimes I make the extreme kinds of statements that get me in trouble. Like the dude who shoved his fist through the window at me over at the White Eagle Tavern that night we women were dancing together. They don't think women just might like to go in a bar and throw down a few gins with another woman. If a woman stands at a bar with 1 foot up having a snort, they think she's looking for sex. I've been having trouble deciding who to go home with recently. You stop and eat. By the time you get home, the damn dawn's happening and birds are singing. You're really wasted, and you're with this dude, and they are always the come down from your original hit. So there they are in your bed, and you can't sleep. It's sure nice to come home with a lady and look out the window at the pretty dawn and then go to bed. It's really peaceful. If I get married again, I think I will marry a woman. I would probably say a lot now, looking forward to the ability to survive when you can't hustle anymore. I have tried to explain to people for years why I exploited the exploiter. Nude dancing and stuff. Getting where you want doesn't involve the moral taboos of people that are seeking each other and not getting anywhere. I feel less and less introspective. I've got my crochet slippers on, and I don't feel weird about not washing my hair for 2 weeks. Anything you could choose to do with your life could turn out to be without meaning. A man I used to live with, Mark, had a show of his work in Portland. I met him when he had a coffee house in Walla Walla. Someone who thought I was a beatnik told me there was a beatnik place in Walla Walla where they held poetry readings. Later, when I moved to Portland, I somehow knew he was there. We got together and reacquainted ourselves. He painted a lot and took a lot of drugs. Opium, mescaline, MDA, THC, STP, LSD, etc. We were stoned a lot and took a lot of dope and spent a lot of time contemplating things. Anyway, there was a sort of a reunion of the people from those days at Mark's show. They all have jobs or are housewives. They all have a kid about 3 and are buying their own home and collecting antiques. I guess I don't have any fantasies left about my life. All the old fantasies that were there had to do with having money and a place and peace. And they all had to do with getting a man. no matter how abstract the exotic adventure. You got to climb over other women if you go through men to find your dreams. And those were excerpts from The Worthy Advisor from Marjorie, who has recently died. And those two letters that David said he included in his letter, I will now read. And this is by David A. Horowitz. Thoughts on Democracy's Future. Letter to a Progressive Friend, September 2017. I have sort of combined the letters. Although you and I come out of a highly politicized generational cohort, there are many young people who simply don't relate to politics, and though it may defy what seems to be pure logic, don't see anything in it that affects their lives. I know you believe that if the Democrats had a sufficiently progressive agenda that objectively related to people's circumstances, they would be mobilized. But that, I believe, is a completely untested proposition that may simply be a fantasy. As I have been trying to emphasize in our back and forth, the literature from Kahneman and Lakoff and Edsel and Dion tells us that people don't vote on what may be considered their rational interests, but tend to follow their passions and emotional identifications. As you know, I don't believe the internet has rectified this inconvenient truth. The second thought is that even if the Democrats were able to elect a progressive president, the structure of Congress and the political system pretty much guarantees that that leader would find him or herself in a legislative stalemate. Any scenario has to take into account that huge swaths of American territory are substantially hostile to the liberal agenda. If you say that campaign finance reform has to happen for any substantive changes in policy, find me the 67 senators and 288 House members needed for the two-thirds vote to approve a constitutional amendment, and the 38 legislatures for three-fourths vote of the states to ratify it. In the end, it seems difficult to avoid more of the dispiriting polarization and stalemate that is destroying the ability of this society and civilization to survive in physical terms, climate change, and to survive and to thrive in anything resembling a democracy. The best way out of this, I believe, is to support candidates and policies that don't frighten substantial portions of the electorate and that appeal to the common sense and reasonable qualities of sufficient numbers of the electorate by emphasizing the qualities of trust and empathy, not anger and divisiveness. I agree with the author of the piece from CNBC you forwarded with Hillary Clinton's habit of censoring her own thoughts and emotions, as she herself now admits, made her a distant figure for many voters. Part of the problem has to do with traditional expectations of women who are, like African Americans, not supposed to come off as angry and divisive. She now second-guesses her failure to respond to former FBI Director James Comey's allegations of her being careless regarding the emails, and also for going light on Bernie Sanders at Obama's urging. She says that Bernie's unrealistic proposals, I assume she means break up the banks, free college tuition, immediate $15 an hour minimum wages, and single-payer medical care, made her look like the bad guy and part of the establishment. Yet Hillary placed a premium on free but means-tested public college education, training, infrastructure spending, and even supported a gradual series of minimum wage hikes, all issues that spoke to the heart of the economic agenda her critics accuse her of ignoring. But there's a lot more to consider along these lines. The establishment that Hillary identified with had produced the highest job growth and lowest unemployment since 2007, in what a University of Michigan labor economist has described as a record-long recovery. The former chief economist of the Department of Labor has noted that the job market has almost totally recovered from its devastating decline during the Great Recession. With 11 million jobs restored during Obama's presidency, the labor market actually approached full employment by the end of 2016, with the most jobs created in small and mid-sized companies. The same period brought significant wage growth. In 2016 alone, wage growth amounted to 2.9%, the strongest since the recession. As the Labor Department economist points out, the challenge of the future will be solving the mismatch between the types of jobs people used to have and the types of jobs the economy is currently creating. A survey by ADP Research Institute, which produces the private sector jobs report, reports that 80% of employers believe their top management challenge stems from a shortage of skilled workers. This suggests that Hillary's incremental campaign proposals were exactly what the economy needs, both in terms of job creation and healthier wage scales. Non-college educated entry-level wind turbine technicians make $60,000 a year. Putting aside the social conservatives who voted for Trump to pack the Supreme Court, and the business and professional Republicans who voted for a tax cut and deregulated finance and industry, we have the non-college educated white working class voters, particularly in rural America and the Midwest, who supposedly voted for the end of trade agreements and restoration of the old industries like coal and steel. Yet this segment of the Trump base doesn't seem dismayed at the fact that the administration has not acted on these promises and doesn't seem to care about economic policy at all. To me, it is clear that these supporters were voting on the gut issues of immigration, a rhetorical wall, and race, protection of police, not economic issues. Their perspective is basically one of resentment toward cosmopolitan, urbane, college-educated, professional elites. All the literature from Kahneman and Lakoff tell us that people make political choices based on the framework and emotional connections they associate with cultural issues. In this sense, it seems a fantasy to believe that resentful white-collar workers would ever gravitate to culturally liberal democratic progressives, no matter what economic agenda progressive leaders offered. Republican operatives are already deriding prospective democratic congressional candidates as supporters of single-payer medical care and therefore supporters of tax increases on the middle class. In the end, progressives may be entering as much fantasy as the hardcore Trump followers by imagining an alienated working class, motivated by economic reasons progressives relate to, instead of seeing cosmopolitan culture as the issue. I say two cheers for emotional intelligence, a term psychologists use, and the ability to fuse contradictory arguments into a plausible synthesis. And that was Thoughts on Democracy's Future by David A. Horowitz, Letter to a Friend. And that's to a former, to a fellow teacher up in the gorge, Bob Williams, another old friend of both of ours. And aside from his teaching chores, history professor emeritus David A. Horowitz is currently working with the Portland State University History Office preparing a digital version of a biography he wrote about his parents, Dorothy and Nathan, Two on the Isle, a Judaic-American tale of romance and creative dreams. The book includes excerpts from several pieces of their writings published in the North Coast Times-Eagle, of which I was once publisher. And in closing, a few moments to remember Mohandas Gandhi, whose birthday was October 2nd. He was born in 1869 and assassinated in January 1948. Albert Einstein said of Gandhi, "Generations to come will scarce believe that one such as this, in flesh and blood, walked upon the earth." Gandhi himself said, pertinent to the present flocculence, "Truth never damages a cause that is just. There is no escape for any of us save through truth and nonviolence. I firmly believe that freedom won through bloodshed or fraud is no freedom." In regard to human self-obliteration, Gandhi said, "What difference does it make to the dead whether the mad destruction is wrought in the name of totalitarianism or the holy name of liberty or democracy?" The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated, Gandhi said. And today, October 5th, in 1813, the great Shawnee chief Tecumseh was killed in battle against Americans in the War of 1812, whom he had also fought against during the Revolution while organizing intertribal resistance to white occupation of native lands. This is Michael McCusker.